This is Hannah Silver interviewing Mrs. Anadora Weideman from Minneapolis, Minnesota on April 17, 1984. Where were you born, Anadora?
I was born in Brandenburg, which is currently located in the DDR, about 30 miles west of Berlin.
That's the east zone of Germany.
That's the eastern part of Germany, yes.
Yeah. And when were you born?
I was born in 26 and started school in 1933 and graduated from high school in 1945, which means my training through my formative years ran parallel to the Nazi time.
Exactly, yeah. What kind of neighborhood did you live in?
I lived in a semi-rural, early suburban neighborhood, and our neighbors belonged primarily to the middle class, lower middle class, I should say.
Mm-hmm. What was the occupation of your father?
My dad was a civil servant in municipal administration. He also belonged to the Socialist Party, the SPD in Germany, and he lost his position in 1933.
Immediately after Hitler came to power?
Yes.
And did he get any compensation?
No, he did not. As a matter of fact, he put in petitions repeatedly and was, after about 2 years, finally awarded the lowest possible remuneration. I don't know what you would call it, that he received a pension, but it was a nominal one.
So could you exist on it?
Not at all.
Did you have brothers or sisters?
I had one younger brother, and we sustained ourselves through these years because we had a big garden and we had a very good family and everybody chipped in, and that's how we survived until my dad retrained himself and worked in the economy. He became an accountant.
Uh-huh. And he had no difficulty then finding a job in the private industry?
He did not, because he had in the early days as a civil servant, he had many contacts with businessmen. And when he lost his job, he did, after he received additional training, he did have office and people respected him enough to hire him into private industry.
Mm-hmm. So then, from then on, you could make a decent living?
Yes, he made an adequate living. It was good enough so that he could support the family and retain his house.
Mm-hmm. So you started your first grade exactly at the same time when Hitler came to power. So what do you remember of your early school days?
Instead of going into the suburban school system, I was put into a one-room rural school, a village school. And I remember having an old teacher, something like 60-some years old, who was a member of the Nazi Party. I remember seeing his lapel and that little bonbon on there. However, he was an interesting man, and I liked my school experience a whole lot because I was put together with kids of all ages.
And for the whole period?
For the first 3 years of my grade school training. And the effect was that he didn't talk a whole lot about the Nazi time, but he was a real buff on physical fitness. And that was early associated to, you had to be fit to serve your Führer and all this stuff. So that was associated in my mind. We went through all these fired things.
But did he not try to influence you in a direct way?
he did in the sense that he integrated political propaganda in various fields of instruction. And the one example I remember vividly was that during drawing or art classes, I was a very good little artist. I liked to draw. In the pre-Christmas time, I drew a Santa Claus, and he had his knapsack full of gifts for children, and he had a flag sticking out, which was the swastika flag. And I was lauded for a good rendition of this thing, and I was very proud that it was shown to all the other age kids and held up as a model of good art. And when I took it home to my father, he took me aside and said, "Don't ever do this sort of thing again. We are ashamed of this flag. This man, Hitler, has even changed the flag in Germany, and we don't want to show it, and you shouldn't show it in connection with Santa Claus."
And after the first 3 years, where did you go to school then?
Then I was changed into the city school system. And what followed me there was that every time I was put in, my dad's name was recognized. When I had to say my dad was Eric Weidemann, they said, "Was he the Social Democrat?" And I would say yes. So that there was always a slight suspicion on the part of a lot of these administrators of who I would be like. And I always felt put on the carpet because I had to prove that I was a good student, that I was as good or better than the others, because politically my family was suspect. I never felt really that I was being persecuted for that, especially. But I had a very critical attitude, and I was very skeptical, and I was on my toes half the time. And as I progressed with my education, I was checked and balanced very well, because I would come home and discuss certain things with my father, and he would always set me right on things.
This was at the very young age, like 9, 10 years old.
Yes. And in a time like that, and in a political system of that type, you learned very early that you couldn't say everything you thought, that you thought twice before you said certain things to certain people, and that you also felt you were justified in lying, that is, paying a certain amount of lip service in order to appear non-suspect. When you switched from the school to the home, you operated on two different planes. And my fortune was that I had a father who constantly supervised and guided me and balanced me in my views.
How about the other students? What was their attitude? Did you find out what their parents felt by their behavior?
When you had an intimate relationship with a close friend, you would occasionally talk about things of a political nature. The easy way was always to leave it out and limit yourselves to school and recreational activities. The political background of your parents were usually quite apparent, because you knew what profession they belonged to, what positions they held. And in Germany, there is traditionally, or there used to be traditionally, a tremendous degree of class consciousness anyway, and you knew where you fit in, and you very often knew where the others fit in, especially on the high school level, where there was a selective upper middle class group of people. Very few belonged to the working class in those days, maybe 5%. The rest of them belonged to the upper middle class. And all the others knew that my dad was a fired civil servant, so that this also meant he couldn't be trusted on the narcissistic base.
And it was also a small town. Everybody knew, not everybody, but most people knew who everybody was.
Yes.
And especially in the neighborhood, you knew about everybody.
Yes. in our neighborhood, for instance, there were people that belonged to the Nazi Party, and they just slid along, so to speak, to keep their jobs. But we also had the neighborhood officials that reported directly to the party, and they were the dedicated people. And you were taught from early on in Germany that the way to greet each other was to use the Heil Hitler salute. And if you refused to do that as an adult, you could occasionally run a risk of being turned in. And my father told us not to use that. We could use it in school, that was beyond his control, but privately, when we went for walks and met people, we would always say, Guten Tag, never Heil Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And as the Nazi time progressed and we entered the war, that became actually an act of opposition and was quite risque.
Were there many others who greeted you back with Guten Tag instead of Heil Hitler?
Most people in those days in the small town on an informal base would answer the way they were spoken to. Mm-hmm. So if you said Guten Tag, they would say Guten Tag. Mm-hmm. If, however, they were in uniform and you said Guten Tag, that would be an affront, and they would probably even try to rebuke you by raising their voice and saying Heil Hitler.
Mm-hmm. Did you have many friends?
I did not have too many friends. I had some very good girlfriends, but just few, maybe two of them. I was withdrawn because actually I was taught to be on my toes, and I don't think that helped me being very sociable. I also was a very ambitious young girl. I always felt I had to prove to the others that I could be as good or better, and that is not very, that does lend itself to being very popular.
Did you have Jewish girls in your class?
I did not, because when I started high school, that was in 1936-37. The situation had already gotten critical. And since most high school students belonged to the upper middle class, these Jewish families had already moved from my area. I remember that there were one or two girls in school who were what was called then half Jewish, whatever that was. And they were accepted, but they stood out. Everybody was aware of them. And so you had this attitude of the Nazi daughters to ignore them, and the others falling over backward to be extra special nice, so that they really had a hard time being like everybody else. And all of a sudden in 1938, they disappeared. That coincided somehow with the Kristallnacht activities, that they were forced to be taken out of the public schools.
And even do you remember that particular night or the days around that date?
I remember that because I saw pictures in the paper of broken shop windows and all kinds of vandalism and men in Nazi uniforms standing in front. And my father talking about that and explaining to me that from then on the Nazis would keep a record of anyone insisting on shopping in these stores. Mm-hmm. And a week later, I remember that my dad had to go to get a pair of shoes and went to a store that had been boarded up but was opened again. And the local paper published his name and showed him in front of the store saying he insists on buying from Jews. So that didn't go on much farther because they drove them out right after that totally.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember the Kristallnacht, but I didn't understand the scope of it. To me, it meant that on downtown Main Street, three shops were vandalized, and my father was the one that told me that the Nazis went in and that they invited the population to loot.
And they did?
And they did.
Mm-hmm. And did you hear, or your father hear, what happened to the Jewish owners?
my father knew that they were leaving, and I don't know under what circumstances they left, whether they were arrested or whether they were deported. I don't know that. I just remembered at that time that harm had been done. And we didn't really know whether the families had a chance to emigrate. However, I knew about some families that owned department stores that my grandfather had business relations with. And they stayed in town waiting for a visa to leave for Australia. And during that time, they were under a state of house arrest.
Mm-hmm.
They were not arrested properly, but it had been indicated to them that it wouldn't be safe for them to be seen in the streets anymore. And they had young children and asked my grandfather, would it be possible that the nanny could take the kids into our garden so that they could get fresh air and use the swing? And I remember that they came twice a week and very cautiously just walked through the garden to play in the sandbox and use the swing. And I looked at them. I couldn't understand why they didn't go to the public park. And my grandfather took me aside and said, I don't want you to talk about it. That's none of your business. These kids will use the swing, and you will share it with them. And you will understand later on why we do this. And so I had a feeling that they were very special people. However, in what way they were special, I did not fully understand.
Do you know what happened to that particular family?
Yes. They were disowned. That is, all their holdings were confiscated. But I think they made it out before the war broke out and emigrated to Australia.
And they stayed there. That's
the last I heard.
Yeah.
I also remember that my pediatrician when I was a little kid was a man by the name of Dr. Landsberger, whom I really loved. He was a very gentle man. And we applied for another checkup, and I was looking forward to going there. And all of a sudden, that was in 1937, we went there, and he was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And then my dad said, he left because it wasn't safe for the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they emigrated to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember that you ever saw any signs of anti-Nazi activity? Or did your father tell you about it?
My father listened, even before the war, to the BBC in the middle of the night. And that was a dangerous thing, because if they ever caught you or anybody denounced you, you would end up in the penitentiary or in a concentration camp. So that since the papers were censored very heavily and subject to Nazi propaganda, this was really his only source of genuine information. And he indicated to me that there were forces working together in the underground, and that even if Hitler started a war, he was convinced it would be finished within a few years because there were people caring, because they would probably try to do anything they could to finish that war. When the war actually started, I was scared to death because I was convinced it was lost. My dad always took a big world map and showed us the Western Allies, the Eastern Allies on the other side, and Germany. And he said, you don't have to be very bright to see that one little country can't subjugate the whole world. And so when the war broke out, he said that we would probably lose that as soon as the Russians joined the war. And he was absolutely devastated when Hitler struck a deal with Stalin and decided to checkmate the Eastern Front. And obviously that prolonged the war, but it never shattered his conviction that we would lose it sooner or later anyhow.
Did you have any relatives who also were opposed to Nazis and suffered through it?
Yes. My uncle, the husband of my aunt on my mother's side, was a city manager in Brandenburg and exposed in the sense that he also belonged to the state parliament. And he was the speaker of the state parliament belonging to the SPD. So his name was well known. And as soon as the Nazis came into power, they rounded up anyone that had had an exposed position. And so they rolled up at 3 o'clock in the morning with a truck in front of the house downtown and hammered on the front gate. And my aunt woke up and opened the door, and they pushed past her and said, "Where's your husband?" Pulled him out of bed in his pajamas and threw him on the truck, and he disappeared. And they didn't know for at least 10 days where his whereabouts were. He wasn't in the municipal prison, and he wasn't any place else they could establish. And 10 days later, someone sent out a message that he had been seen at Sachsenhausen in
the concentration camp
north of Berlin. And he was not allowed to send any messages, and he returned after about 2 months. And he had worked in the city government and also helped work in the pub we had. My grandmother owned a pub, and was a very rotund, very healthy looking man. And when he came back, he had lost 100 pounds. He refused to talk about any of his experiences to the family, and he couldn't look anyone in the eye. He always looked down. He was in a prolonged state of depression and shock, and it took him about a year to work his way back to some degree of normalcy. And when Hitler's headquarters in East Prussia was blown up by a rebellion of his officers in 1944, he was rounded up again alongside a lot of the people that belonged to the
Are you talking about the 20 July 1944?
Yes.
Oh.
And he was gone then again for about 2 months.
Your uncle?
The same one. Mm-hmm. And he was sent back to Sachsenhausen. And he was sent out with a warning that if he took up any contact with any member of the underground, he would be hanged. And so overtly he stayed very neutral, stayed in the house, didn't move around, didn't make any phone calls, and survived to the end of the war.
And then he recovered? Or did he?
Yes, he did recover, and he was, again, very active in reconstructing the Social Democratic Party. And since it was in the DDR, that is in the East Zone, he very soon ran into trouble with the communists and had to flee there too.
And he went to the West?
He went to the West and became a city manager in Langenhagen, close to Hanover.
In West Germany?
In West Germany, yeah.
And how about your father? Did he get reinstated?
My dad got reinstated and became the director of social work in my hometown. The mayor then was a communist, and my dad was a socialist, a lifelong socialist, and that lasted for about 2 months, and then they made him resign again because they didn't trust him. They thought he was not truly a fellow traveler of the system.
And did he stay to the end in the...
Yes, he stayed. He went back into private industry. He had been trained during the Nazi times. And until his retirement, he stayed in Brandenburg. He was a very loyal local patriot and couldn't see to leave for the West. And so he spent his last years in Brandenburg.
And when did you leave for the West?
I left in... very legally. I was never a refugee. I was admitted to the Humboldt University in East Berlin as a student, as a freshman, And when the Free University opened in West Berlin, I switched and became a member of the first semester there. And that's where I had my initial contact with Hannah Velver, who and opened her home to a lot of hungry students, and we were very active politically and needed a warm place to go, and she did not just provide the warm place but also a wonderful meal once a week, and we were sitting in her home discussing politics after 1945.
And you also helped with the establishment of the Free University, with the groundwork for it.
Yes, in a way we did. We were sort of charter members helping it from, from the initial stage into being a more successful institution.
And when you started to go to the Free University, did you have any Jewish students there?
I think we did have students that were members of the Jewish faith, but at that time, you know, I can't recall, I couldn't pinpoint anyone. They were just buddies.
Yeah.
It didn't matter. And I don't think that there was any real profile. They had student groups and clubs from the Protestant Church and the Catholic Church, but I didn't belong to any of those. And I had friends in any of the groups.
Did you know of any German non-Jews who helped Jews either to hide or to leave or in support? Did you hear anything about it?
Yes, I did, but on a very small scale. I don't think I knew during the Nazi times of anyone that sheltered Jews, but I knew that, for instance, my grandparents lived in a workers' district in an apartment building. They owned it, and their next door neighbors owned an apartment building, and there was a party. There was a Jewish worker who lived there with his three children, and I don't know what happened to the husband, but the wife and the kids stayed there, and they were not taken. However, they were put on a terrible ration system, much lower than anyone else.
They didn't get any meat there.
And my grandmother would always make sure that, since she had an orchard, that this woman could come over and get fruit for her kids.
Vegetables
and things like that. And there was always a degree of concern, were they still there? I mean, you know, if they didn't show up for a week, she would send us over and say, tell her there's fruit there, just to check. And they actually stayed. And I don't know what happened to the husband. It might be that the husband was not Jewish, that the wife and the kids were.
But they survived?
They did survive, yes. And, you know, persecution took many things. I remember we had an elderly couple next door in the same house. They were Jehovah's Witnesses. And the husband was taken, and he did not survive. They made him abjure in prison. If he promised to sign that he would never follow his faith, they said they would let him go, and he didn't. And I think he was beaten to death. I remember that.
For being a Jehovah's
Witness.
And
those people that actually harbored or helped Jews hide away, obviously did never talk about it. And I got very cynical about this after the war, because suddenly you heard of many people bragging or protesting that they had helped Jews, that I discarded a lot of these things as just trying to whitewash their own or trying to cover up feelings of guilt. And I'm sure some people did, but they were very often the ones that never talked about that.
Mm-hmm. Over. you did know people of whom you know they had help, didn't you?
Yes, I did. But as I said before, there was danger in ever mentioning things while it was going on, so they were very tight-lipped and very calm. As a matter of fact, they might have camouflaged it by being overtly even pro-Nazi to make sure that no one suspected anything. I knew about a woman who helped by traveling to Switzerland, clearing passport possibilities, and while going across the border, attempting and being successful in smuggling out assets for the family that was supposed to leave. I also knew of people that tried to help in giving food to people, to Jewish people, families, in a very casual way, to make sure that they didn't starve, because everybody knew that you were not given the same ration if you were part Jewish or Jewish. You were on the very lowest subsistence level as far as rations were concerned. On the other hand, I can't be terribly specific because I was really too young to be involved, and also rather young to be made a confidant in things like that. You had to always worry that if people had knowledge, the pressure could be such that they might give something away. And so I'm sure that in my family there was a certain amount of caution executed, not to mention too much to us kids.
Could you tell me about any experiences you had with acquaintances?
In our neighborhood, we had actually a very close relationship with one another. And one of the neighbors was, in the beginning of the Nazi era, quite sympathetic to the system. He had risen and felt very important, and tried to indicate to my father that he wasn't following the right course in his reluctance to accept that system. The war broke out, and this man was drafted into the infantry. And before he left, he talked to my father and said, "We've had our differences politically and so on, but now I'm leaving my wife behind and she'll live in this house all alone. Would you mind looking after things in my absence?" And my father said, "Of course, I'll see to it that I can help." And he was trained and sent to the Eastern Front.
Was he drafted into the regular army?
He was drafted into the regular run-of-the-mill GI type of mm-hmm. troop. And he left for the Eastern Front, and we didn't hear from them for a while. And a year later or so, his wife suddenly received news from a sanatorium, a rehabilitation hospital. And we were a little bit surprised about it. And then she indicated a few months later again that he was due on leave. And when he came back, he visited my father. He was in uniform, and as he rang the doorbell, we didn't even recognize him. He had aged by about 15 years. He looked very wan, and he was white-haired, and he was very nervous, and he had lost a lot of weight. And my father asked him in, and he said, "I would like to talk to you, but I can't do it here. Can we go out and go for a walk in your garden?" My dad said, "Yes, we can," and disappeared, and they were gone for a long, long time. And later on, this man had already left again, going back to wherever he had been treated. I asked my father how he had been doing, and then he hesitated, and he said, "I'll tell you." He came back and he actually cried. He apologized to me and said, "You are so right about that system. They had
sent him to Russia, and at first he was just part of the occupying force. And one of the days he had been rounded up, his whole platoon, for special duty. And they took him to a village, and he found out shortly before that he had been detached to be an execution platoon and taken out into the open area someplace quite away from the rest of the troops. And they were told they would have to shoot these civilian people. And he recognized that they had been Jewish people that were driven out of the villages and rounded up that way. And as they were getting ready, they got the orders to shoot. This man just fainted and went berserk, just didn't remember anything from that time and had to be taken to the mental institution. And my father told me that and indicated that that confirmed everything that he had heard over the BBC radio news and so on. And he had not known the scope of it or the immediacy of it. And here, one of our very own neighbors was involved.
And was an eyewitness.
He was an eyewitness, and I think he, as long as he lived, never forgot this. And he mentioned it many times after the war, even to my father, that he owed him so much, that he owed him this apology. He owed it to all kinds of people, but that my father had predicted it and he didn't want to believe, and it had to go so far that he would be thrown into the situation before he could see.
Did he completely recover from that, or did he still suffer? You mentioned he had nightmares. And
yeah, I think he never really completely recovered. He was depressed much of the time, and I think he was on some kind of a disability pension. He had been a very active man, a stonemason, and I don't think he ever worked regularly after that. He suffered from depression.
Yeah. Did you listen to the BBC on a regular basis?
I did not, but I knew my father did. My father got up every night at 2 p.m. That was when one of the broadcasts came.
2 a.m.
2 a.m., I'm yeah. sorry, yeah. And he would wait till everybody was in bed. We had a maid that lived in the house, and we didn't know whether she was to be trusted, so he couldn't listen at 10 or at 8. He listened at 2 a.m. And he would take a wool blanket and put it over his head and then tune in the radio so that any kind of jamming distortions wouldn't be too noisy.
Which was so very loud,
yes.
The jamming.
And we would sit at breakfast in the morning, and he would tell us the latest news about the various fronts and so on. And that, too, was quite dangerous. If you were caught or if somebody denounced you, you would end up in a camp someplace.
Yeah. Did you know of other people who were listening to
this? Yes.
My
grandmother had a blind cousin. And this person, he was quite advanced in years. He listened and had renters in his own little home. And he had some kind of an argument with them. And in revenge, they turned him in. And he ended up in the penitentiary in Bautzen. And he was done away with by the Nazis.
He did not serve? They killed him?
They gave him a term. He had to serve 5 years for listening to a foreign radio station. But he never survived to the end of the war. And as far as we can see, he was put away because he was inferior because of his blindness, in addition to having
listened to the foreign radio.
Yes.
So in other words, your father was always rather well informed.
He was.
Yeah.
He was well informed because he insisted to
yeah.
listening to the BBC,
yeah.
and he considered that a very objective newscast. My youngest brother started out listening to Radio Moscow, and my father was quite disturbed about that because he didn't trust the Russian news reports. So father and son would have occasional discussions when the maid was not around, and they were comparing notes on how certain things had been reported.
Yeah. And did your father tell other people who did not listen, trustworthy people, that he spread what he had heard?
Yes, he did. As the war progressed and things got worse and worse, there were more and more people that really did tune in on those broadcasts. And there was a kind of a grapevine of people that knew each other that could compare notes. However, you had to be very careful and cautious in whom you approached upon these things.
How were the last days of the war, just before the end?
Towards the end of the war, about 6 weeks prior to it, I was taken out of high school and put in a factory to supposedly help the last war effort. And by that time, fighter planes were flying over. We were being bombed in my hometown. And the moods of the active Nazi population changed. You saw fewer and fewer brown uniforms. They were carefully folded up and not flaunted anymore. And you would see in the paper, in the local paper, we will fight with our last drop of blood. As the Russians approached from the east by the end of April, and we also heard that the Western Front had totally collapsed, we were told that our hometown would be declared an open city, that there wouldn't be any unnecessary fighting, and that our mayor, who was a Nazi-appointed active supporter of the system, would stick it out with us and help us through the difficult times. Within a week prior to the final occupation, this man took a Red Cross ambulance and left with his family in that Red Cross ambulance towards the west across the Elbe River and gave himself up to the British troops. That was the kind of support that they provided. There were some Nazi teachers that stayed and didn't flee. The majority of the Nazi leadership really did flee. But some of my teachers in high school did not. And what we heard immediately after the occupation was that they were arrested and disappeared towards the east. And we don't know what
you
came
mean arrested by the Russians?
By the Russians
and were shipped
away. But the local leadership had prudently removed themselves towards the west because they expected better treatment from the American and British and French troops.
By that time, were there any Jews you knew of left in Brandenburg?
I don't think so. I knew of people. This was very technical. If they were half Jews, for instance, then they had a chance to survive, but truly Jewish families, I don't think,
left by that time.
Yes.
And did any come back immediately after the war?
Yes. No, not people that practiced the Jewish faith. I'm sure of that. The synagogue had been burned. They didn't come. And in addition to that, it was even aggravated by the fact that that was Soviet-occupied, and I don't think they would have liked to come to the eastern part of Germany in the first place.
Yeah. So this was then the end of the thousand-year Reich, right?
Yes, that's what it was. The thousand-year Reich had crashed.
Yeah. And after that, you went to West Berlin eventually.
Yes. Originally, there was no real separation between West and East Berlin because the wall
didn't
exist.
Came up in
I was admitted to the university, the Humboldt University, which happened to be in the eastern part of Berlin. And that's where I went.
And then you changed over to the Free University.
I changed over to the Free University when the conditions in the East became very oppressive, the Russians controlled the curriculum. And
then you were fortunate to live in the West.
Then,
and you didn't have to escape.
I lived
in
the Western and the free part, and occasionally visited my hometown and watched conditions there. But I never returned there to live.
Yeah. Okay. There was one incident worth mentioning in connection with the plot to assassinate Hitler. The police came to Father and told him that there would be an action, and he is on the list to be arrested the following day. This was in July 44. And that the police would take him in and put him in jail for protective custody. He was not questioned and well treated. 4 days later, he was told to go home. The action is over. So this stay in jail really protected him from arrest and the fate of many others. Thank you very much, Anadora. By the way, the name is Anadora Russell, née Weidemann.